Session 16. Well, I thought about your suggestion, Doc, and I'm not sold. I know no one is actually trying to harm me. It's all in my head. So making a list of anyone who might want to seems goofy as all get out. Tell you what I will do, though. The next time I'm feeling paranoid, I'll make a mental list, and when I can't think of a single name to put on it, I'll feel like a dumbass, which beats feeling paranoid. Blue scarf you're wearing looks great with your eyes, by the way. You're pretty stylish for an older woman, you know, with your black turtlenecks and long fitted skirts. A classy look. No, streamlined. Like you don't have time for bullshit, even when it comes to your clothes. I've always tended to dress conservatively, the exact opposite of Mom's style, Hollywood housewife. But Christina, who was my personal shopping guru, had been trying to coax me out into the light before I was abducted. Poor girl wasn't having much luck with me, though. I generally avoided shopping, especially in the fancy stores she liked. My favorite suit was the result of an accidental walking by the store window I have to have it moment. If there was an event I had to go to, I just headed over to Christina's house. She'd bounce around, ripping things out of her closet, draping me with scarves and necklaces, telling me how pretty I looked in this dress or that color. She loved doing it, and I loved having someone decide for me. She was really generous with her hand-me-downs, too. Christina got bored with clothes the week after she bought them, and a lot of my wardrobe was made up of her cast-offs. That's why I still can't figure out why I got so pissed at her for trying to give me clothes when I got back from the mountain. When I found out Mom had gotten rid of all my clothes, I loaded up at the Goodwill. Man, you should have seen the look on Mom's face when she saw the oversized jogging suits and sweatpants I brought home. I didn't care what color anything was, it just had to be soft and warm-looking. The baggier, the better. Running around up there in all those girly dresses the freak liked made me feel so exposed. One thing you can say for the way I dress now, nobody's tempted to look underneath. Luke called Sunday morning and asked if I wanted to get together and take the dogs for a walk. The first word out of my mouth was no. Before I could soften my reply with a reason, believable or otherwise, he launched into a rundown on something going on at the restaurant. The thought of seeing him again terrified me. What if he tried to touch me and I pulled back again? I couldn't stand to see that hurt look in his eyes a third time. What if he didn't try to touch me? Would that mean he didn't care anymore? Now that I'd said no, I wondered if he'd suggest a walk again. I wasn't sure if I'd feel any braver next time, but I knew I didn't want him to stop asking. When I did finally drag my butt outside to take Emma for a walk, I couldn't stop thinking about Luke and wondering what it would have been like if he was with me. The next morning, instead of camouflaging myself with yet another shapeless jogging suit, I carried up from the basement the box of clothes Christina had dropped off on my doorstep months ago. I didn't realize until I checked out the faded jeans and sage-colored sweater in a mirror how long it had been since I'd looked in one. It's not like I'd put on a slinky dress. The jeans were a relaxed fit and the sweater wasn't tight. But I couldn't remember the last time I chose something because I liked the color or put on anything even hinting at curves. For a second, staring in the mirror at the stranger wearing Christina's clothes, I almost saw the shadow of the girl I used to be. And it freaked me out so much I wanted to tear off all the clothes. But Emma, anxious for her morning walk, whined at my heels, and I left them on. I don't care what she looks like, and she doesn't care what I look like. Emma stayed at my mom's while I was missing. Definitely not my first choice, and it sure wouldn't have been Emma's. Later, I found out Luke and a couple of my friends offered to take her, but my mom said no. When I asked her why she took Emma, she said, "What was I supposed to do with her? Can you imagine what people would have said if I'd given her away?" Poor dog got so excited when she first saw me, she started dribbling pee. She's never done that, even as a puppy, and shaking so hard I thought she was having a seizure. When I squatted down to hug her, she shoved her head into my chest and whined for the longest time, telling me all her woes. And she had a right to complain. For one thing, she was tied up to the Japanese maple tree in Mom's backyard, and Emma had never been tied up in her life. Mom said she'd been digging in her garden beds. No doubt. She probably thought she'd landed in dog hell and was trying to dig her way out. Judging by Emma's long toenails, the last year of her life had mostly been spent tied to that tree. Her fur was matted and her beautiful glossy eyes were dull. On the porch, I found a bag of food, the cheapest crap you could buy, and it smelled moldy. This dog used to sleep with me every night, and I walked her two, sometimes three times a day. She had every dog toy and treat ever manufactured and the softest bed in case she got too hot to sleep with me, and I planned my workday so she never had to be alone for too long. Furious at the way she'd been treated, I wanted to say something. But I'd just come back, and if being around people was like crawling uphill through mud, then talking to Mom was like crawling uphill wearing a heavy backpack. Besides, what could I have said? Hey, Mom, next time I'm abducted, you don't get my dog? After I finally got back to my place, Emma preferred being outside, but it only took a couple of days for her to remember the good life, and she's probably on my couch drooling all over the cushions right now. Her fur is back to shiny gold, and her eyes are once again full of life. She's not the same dog as before, though. She stays a lot closer to me on walks than she used to, and if she does forge ahead, she comes back every few minutes to check on me. I don't think Mom meant to hurt my dog, and if I accused her of cruelty, she'd be shocked. She didn't raise her fist to Emma, not that I know of anyway, but I doubt she would. But she didn't give her any love for a year, and as far as I'm concerned, that's just as damaging as physical blows. Mom would never get that lack of affection is abuse. After my baby died, I blocked out my grief by focusing on my hatred for the freak as he forced me to continue with my daily routines like she'd never existed. Late one morning, after about a week of this, he went outside to chop wood in preparation for winter. I thought it was close to the end of July, but I wasn't sure. Time only counts when you have a purpose. Sometimes I forgot to make a mark on the wall, but it didn't matter. I knew I'd been there for almost a year, because when he opened the door, I'd caught the scent of hot earth and warm fir trees, the same scents that filled the air on the day he took me. While he cut wood, I was inside sewing some buttons on his shirt. I kept sneaking little glances at the baby's basket, but then I'd see her blanket hanging neatly over the side where he'd placed it and jab the needle into my finger instead of the fabric. After about 20 minutes, he came back inside and said, "I have a job for you." The only other time he'd asked for my help was with a deer, and as he motioned for me to follow him outside, nerves made my legs go rubbery. Still gripping the shirt and with my hand holding the needle suspended in the air, I stared at him. His flushed face glowed with a fine sheen of sweat. I couldn't tell whether it was from anger or exertion, but his voice was neutral when he spoke. "Come on, we don't have all day." While I followed him out to a pile of large fur rounds, he said over his shoulder, "Now pay attention. Your job is to pick up the pieces as I split them and stack them over there." He pointed to a neat stack that came halfway up the side of the cabin. Once in a while, when I was inside the cabin and he was outside, I heard the sound of a chainsaw running, but I couldn't see any fresh stumps at the edge of our clearing or any drag marks. A wheelbarrow leaned against the pile where he was chopping, so I figured he must have felled a tree in the forest and wheeled the bigger blocks in to be split into smaller pieces. The pile was only about 12 feet from the stack. Seemed to me it would be easier to either chop the tree up into smaller pieces where he'd cut it down, or at least wheel the bigger blocks right next to where they had to be stacked. Just like with the deer, something told me this was him showing off. I hadn't been outside much since the baby died, and as I carried wood to the stack, my eyes searched for any evidence of recently disturbed dirt. I didn't find any, but I was only able to give the river a quick glance before memories of my baby on her blanket in the sun overwhelmed me. After we'd been working for about an hour, I deposited an armload in the stack and came to stand a couple of feet behind him until he finished swinging the axe and it was safe for me to pick up more. He'd taken his shirt off and his back glistened with sweat. He paused for a breather, his back to me and the axe resting on his shoulder. "We can't let this distract us from our ultimate goal," he said. "Nature has a plan." What the hell was he talking about? "But so do I." The shiny blade of the axe lifted high in the air. "It was better we found out early that she was weak." Then I got it, and my frozen heart shattered in my chest. He continued chopping, emitting one little grunt with each downswing, talking in between strokes.
"The next one will be stronger."
Next one.
"It's not quite 6 weeks, but you're healed, so I'm going to let you get pregnant early. We'll start tonight."
I stood perfectly still, but a loud screaming began in my head. There were going to be more babies. It was never going to end. The silver of the axe flashed in the bright sun as he lifted it over his shoulder for the next swing.
"No response, Annie?"
I was saved from having to answer when his axe got caught halfway through a piece of wood. He used his foot to pry the axe out,
then leaned it against the woodpile to his right. With his foot braced on one side of the block, which shifted his body slightly away from the axe, he bent down and tried to break the split apart by hand. Treading softly, I came up behind him on his right, the side angled away. I could have reached over and flicked one of the beads of sweat off his back. He grunted as his hands fought with the wood.
Ouch!
I held my breath as he brought his finger to his mouth and sucked at a sliver. If he turned, we'd be face to face. He bent over again and resumed his struggle with the wood. Keeping my body directly behind him and facing the same direction, I focused my gaze on his back for the slightest sign he was about to turn, then reached for the axe. My hands caressed the warm, smooth wood handle, still slick from his sweat, and curled over it in a tight grip. The weight of it felt right and solid as I lifted it up and brought it to rest on my shoulder. His voice straining with effort, he said,
"We'll have another one by spring."
I lifted the axe high. I screamed,
"Shut up, shut up, shut up!"
as I sank it into the back of his head. It made the strangest sound, a wet thunk. For a few seconds, his body stayed bent. Then he fell over face down with both of his arms and the wood underneath him. He twitched a couple of times, then stilled. Shaking with rage, I leaned over his body and yelled,
"Take that, you sick fuck!"
The forest was quiet. Leaving a red trail in his blonde curls, blood rolled down the side of his head, hit the dry ground with a plop, 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 made a rapidly spreading pool and stopped plopping. I waited for him to turn around and hit me, but as the seconds turned to minutes, my heart rate settled down and I was able to take a few deep breaths. The cut hadn't split his head wide open or anything, but the blonde hair around the axe head, embedded halfway into his skull, was a glistening mass of scarlet, and some of the hair seemed to have gone into the cut. A fly landed and crawled around in the wound, and two more landed. Walking backward to the cabin on weak legs, I hugged my trembling body with my arms. My eyes were mesmerized by the axe handle reaching toward the sky and the crimson halo surrounding his head. Safe inside the cabin, I ripped off my sweaty dress, then ran the shower until it was so hot it almost scalded my skin. Shaking violently, I sat down in the back of the tub, tucked my knees under my chin, and wrapped my arms tight around them to stop the muscle spasms. The water thundered down on my bowed head in a fiery baptism while I rocked myself and tried to comprehend what I'd done. My mind couldn't grasp that he was really dead. Someone like him should have taken a silver bullet, a cross, and a stake through the heart to die. What if he wasn't dead? I should have felt for a pulse. What if he was making his way back to the cabin right now? Despite the hot shower, I shivered. Expecting him to jump out at me, I slowly opened the bathroom door and sent steam billowing out into the empty room. Slowly picked the dress off the floor and pulled it over my head. Slowly made my way to the cabin door. Slowly placed my ear against the cool metal. Silence. I tested the knob, praying the door hadn't locked behind me. It turned. I opened the door just an inch and peeked through. His body was still in the exact same position in the middle of the clearing, but the sun had shifted and the handle of the axe cast a shadow like a sundial. My legs tense in case I had to break into a run, I snuck up on him. Every couple of steps, I paused and strained my eyes and ears for any sounds or the slightest movement. When I finally got up to him, his body looked awkward with his arms under him, and the position made him seem smaller. Holding my breath, I reached around his neck, on the opposite side of the blood river, and checked for a pulse. He was dead. I backed away slowly, then sat on the porch in one of the rocking chairs and tried to figure out my next step. Keeping beat with every creak of the chair, my mind repeated the words, "He's dead. He's dead. He's dead. He's dead. He's dead." In the hot summer afternoon, the clearing was idyllic.
The river, calm without spring's heavy rains, was a soft hum, and the occasional robin, swallow, or blue jay warbled. The only sign of violence was the buzz of the rapidly growing mass of flies that coated his wound in the pool of blood. His words tripped through my reverie. Nature has a plan. I was free, but I didn't feel free. As long as I could see him, he still existed. I had to do something with the body. But what? The temptation to set the son of a bitch on fire was huge, but it was summer. The clearing was dry, and I didn't want to start a forest fire. Digging through the dry, compact ground to bury him would be next to impossible, but I couldn't just leave him there. Even though I'd confirmed he was well and truly dead, my mind refused to accept that he couldn't hurt me anymore. The shed. I could lock him in the shed. Back at his body, I tilted him slightly to the side and searched his front pockets for the keys. With my teeth clamped over the ring, I gripped both of his ankles, then dropped them quickly when I felt his warm skin. I don't know how long it takes a body to cool down, and he was lying in the sun, but it scared me enough that I checked his pulse a second time. Grabbing hold of his ankles again and ignoring their warmth, I tried to drag him backward, but I was only able to move him enough that his body slid off the log round, and when it hit the ground, the axe handle in his head wobbled. I fought the bile rising in my throat, turned my back to him, and tried to pull him that way. I was only able to move him a foot before I had to stop and take a breath. My dress was already damp, and sweat dripped into my eyes. Even though the shed wasn't far away, it might as well have been on the other side of the clearing. Casting my eye around for an alternative, I spied the wheelbarrow. I rolled it over to his body and braced myself for the sensation of his skin touching mine. With my eyes averted from the axe, I gripped him by his upper arms and managed to pull them out from under his body. Eyes still averted, I grasped him under the armpits and with my heels dug into the ground, threw my whole body into trying to haul him up. I could only move him a few inches. I straddled his back and tried to pick him up from around the waist, but I was only able to get him up a foot before my arms began to shake from the exertion. The only way he was getting into that wheelbarrow was if he came back to life and climbed into it himself. Wait. If I had something to roll his body onto, something that would slide across the ground, I might be able to drag him. The rug under the bed wasn't smooth enough. I hadn't noticed a tarp near the woodpile, but he had to have one somewhere, maybe in the shed. After trying 5 keys on his monster keychain, I was able to open the padlock. It took a while because my hands were shaking like a burglar's on his first job. I half expected to see the deer still hanging from the ceiling, but there was no sign of it. And on a shelf above the freezer, I found an orange tarp. Unfolding it near his body, I considered how I was going to roll him over onto the tarp with the axe in his head. Damn. It was going to have to come out. With my hands wrapped around the handle, I closed my eyes and pulled, but it wouldn't budge. I tried a bit more force, and the sensation of flesh and bone resisting as they let go of their prize had me gagging. It had to be done fast. With my foot braced against the base of his neck, I shut my eyes tight, took a deep breath, and wrenched the axe out. I dropped it, bent over, and dry-heaved. Once my stomach settled down, I knelt beside his body, on the opposite side of the blood, and rolled him onto the tarp. He fell onto his back, glassy blue eyes staring up at the sky, a smear of blood on the orange tarp arcing out from his head. His face had already paled, and his mouth was slack. With quick fingers, I closed his eyelids, not out of respect for the dead, but because I thought of all the times I'd had to force myself to look at them. Now, in a few seconds, I'd fixed it so I'd never have to see those eyes again. My back to him, I grasped the edge of the tarp, leaned forward like an ox with a gruesome cargo, and pulled him over to the shed. Getting him over the lip of the doorway was tricky because he kept sliding farther down the tarp. Eventually, I had to drag it out again, move him up it, and fold the end over him like a napkin. Then, with both ends in my hands, I wiggled, dragged, shoved, and pulled him inside. At one point, his hand fell out and touched my knee. I dropped the tarp, leapt backward, and hit my head on a post. It hurt like a son of a bitch, but I was too focused to pay the pounding any attention. I stuffed his arm back in the tarp and tucked it all around him. I found some bungee cords, wound them tight around his legs and upper body. As I wrapped him up like a mummy, I kept telling myself he couldn't hurt me anymore.
Not one part of me believed it. Dehydrated, sweat-soaked, head pounding and aching all over from the physical exertion, I locked the shed and made my way back to the cabin for some water. Once I'd slaked my thirst, I lay on the bed clutching the keys and stared at his keychain pocket watch. It was 5 o'clock, the first time I knew the hour myself in almost a year. At first I didn't think. I just listened to the ticking of the second hand until the pounding headache calmed down. Then I thought, I'm free. I'm finally fucking free. But why didn't I feel like I was? I killed a man. I'm a murderer. I'm just like him. All I'd gotten rid of was a body. During one of the first press conferences I held after I came home, I stupidly thought if I got it all over with at once, they might actually stop calling and lurking outside the trailer. A bald guy in the audience holding a Bible up in the air chanted, "Thou shalt not kill, you're going to hell! Thou shalt not kill, you're going to hell!" The crowd let out a collective gasp as he was dragged off by bystanders, then turned back to me. Camera bulbs flashed, and somebody shoved a microphone in my face.
"How would you respond to what he said, Annie?"
As I looked out at the crowd and the back of the bald-headed guy who was still chanting, I thought, I'm already in hell, asshole. I wish sometimes that I could talk to my mom about these things, Doc, about guilt and regret and shame. But as much as I have a talent for shouldering all the blame, Mom has one for ducking it. Which is one of the reasons I still haven't talked to her since our fight. Not that she's tried either. That doesn't surprise me, but I thought for sure Wayne would have called by now. Shit, I'm getting so damn lonely these days, I might even have to give one of your meet your fears head-on experiments the old college try. But it's just so stupid that I still feel like I'm in danger. The freak is dead. I'm as safe can be. Now can someone please tell my psyche that? Session 17. You know, Doc, all along, even while you were giving me techniques to work through my fears or explaining what might be causing them, I still told myself they'd eventually go away on their own, especially after I read up on all that grief stuff. Then this week, some dickhead broke into my house. I came back from my morning run to find my alarm blaring. Cops parked in my driveway, the door jamb on my back door kicked apart, and my bedroom window open. Judging by the broken branches on my shrubs, that's how the bastard got out. Nothing seemed to be missing, and the cops said they couldn't do much unless I figured out if anything was gone. They also told me there's been a couple of B&Es in my neighborhood recently, but they didn't find any fingerprints at them either, like that was supposed to make me feel better. After they all went home and my full body shaking had subsided to occasional tremors, I headed to my bedroom to change. A thought stopped me in the hallway. Why would you risk going in, but not steal anything? Something wasn't right. I walked around my house slowly, trying to think like a burglar. Okay, bust open the back door, race upstairs, then what? Run to the living room. Nothing small visible. Stereo equipment and TV are too big to grab fast, especially if you're on foot. Run down hallway to bedroom. Search drawers for valuables? I examined each one carefully. All were shut tight and my clothes were neatly folded. Everything still hung straight in the closet and the door was closed evenly, sometimes one side sticks. I stepped back and surveyed the bedroom. A hamper full of clothes I'd just taken out of the dryer was in the same place on the floor, the big t-shirt I sleep in still tossed across the foot of the bed. The bed. Was that a slight indent near the edge? Did I sit there when I put my socks on? I came closer and inspected every inch of the bed. Examined every hair. Mine? Emma's? I brought my nose close to the duvet cover and sniffed the length of it. Was that the faint traces of cologne? I stood up again. A stranger forced his way into my house. Was in my bedroom, looking at my things, touching my things. My skin crawled. I stripped my bed, grabbed my t-shirt, dumped everything in the wash with lots of bleach and wiped down every surface of my house. After I boarded up the back door and the window, house looked like an army bunker by the time I was done, I grabbed the cordless phone and hid in the hall closet for the rest of the day. Gary, the cop I was telling you about, called me later to make sure I was all right,
which was nice of him, considering he doesn't deal with robberies. He backed up what the other cops were saying, that it was most likely a random event and the guy raced in to grab what he could, then panicked and took the quickest exit out. When I argued with him, insisting it was a dumbass thing to do, he said criminals do a lot of stupid things when they're scared. He also suggested I call someone to stay with me or go to a friend's until my door jam was fixed. I may have been scared to death, but no way was I going to my mom's. And friends? Well, even if I wasn't more paranoid than Howard Hughes, I'm not sure how many of those I have left these days. Luke is about the only one who still calls. When I first came back, everyone, friends, old co-workers, people I went to school with but haven't seen in years, was making such a fuss over me I just couldn't handle it. But you know, people only try for so long, and if you keep shutting the door in their face, they eventually go away. Christina is about the only one I'd consider asking, but you know what happened there. Or at least you know about as much as I know, because I still don't understand why I reacted so badly to her. She's probably just trying to be a good friend by leaving me alone now, but sometimes I wish she'd haul off and force me out into the light. Bully me like she used to. Of course, right away I thought about moving, but damn it, I love the house. If I ever sell, it won't be because of some asshole burglar. Not that I could, anyway. How the hell am I going to qualify for a mortgage? I thought about looking for work. I have a whole new set of skills, but I'd hate to see what kind of job they'd land me. All of which leads me to the call I got from Luke when I got home from our last session. My bookkeeper up and quit on me, Annie. Any chance you could take over until I find someone else? It would just be part-time, and
I don't need your help, Luke.
Who said anything about you needing help? This is about me. I need your help. I can't make heads or tails of these books. I feel bad even asking, but you're the only person I know who's good with numbers. I can just bring the stuff to your house. You won't even have to go into the restaurant.
I think it was embarrassment that made me tell him, okay, I could try it, before I realized what I'd just committed to. Later, it was a different story. I'm not ready for this. I almost called and canceled. But I took a few deep breaths and told myself to just sleep on it. Of course, the next morning is when my house got broken into. In the midst of all that drama and the ensuing panic attack, I forgot about my conversation with Luke. Then last night, he left a message that he's going to come over this weekend with an accounting program to load on my computer. He sounded so damn relieved and grateful, I couldn't think of a way out. And I wasn't sure if I really wanted one. I tell myself it's just a business thing on Luke's part, but I'm sure I'm not the only person who could do his bookkeeping. The phone book is full of names. Last Monday night, I had a cold that was threatening to escalate and was sitting at half-mast on the couch in faded blue flannel pajamas and hedgehog slippers, a box of Kleenex in my lap, the TV on but the sound down. A car door slammed at the end of my driveway. I held my breath for a second and listened. Footsteps on the gravel? I peeked out the window but couldn't see anything in the dark. I grabbed the poker from my fireplace. Soft footsteps on the stairs. Then silence. Poker gripped tight, I peered through the peephole but couldn't see anything. Rustling sounds near the bottom of the door. Emma barked. I yelled,
I know you're out there. You better tell me who you are right now.
Jesus Christ, Annie, I was just picking up your paper.
Mom. I slid open the deadbolts. When the locksmith came to repair the door jamb, I had an extra one installed. Emma took one sniff of Mom and headed straight to my room, where she probably crawled under the bed. I felt like joining her.
Mom, why didn't you call first?
With a toss of her head that made her ponytail shimmy, she shoved my paper into my hand and headed back out. I grabbed her shoulders.
Wait, I didn't mean you had to leave, but you scared the crap out of me. I was just dozing off.
She turned around, and with her big blue doll eyes staring at the wall over my shoulder, she said,
Sorry.
Well, that threw me. Even though the sorry did have a slight edge to it, I can't remember the last time my mom apologized for anything. Her gaze traveled down to my hedgehog slippers, and her eyebrows rose. My mom wears marabou feathered high-heeled slippers, summer or winter, and before she could comment on mine, I said, Did you want to come in? As she stepped into the house to stand in the foyer, I noticed she was clutching a large brown paper bag to her chest with one hand. For a second, I wondered if she'd brought some booze with her, but no, the package was flat and square. In her other hand, she held a Tupperware container she now thrust toward me.
Wayne dropped me off on his way into town. I made you some Annie Bear cookies.
Ah. peanut butter cookies in the shape of a bear's paw with chocolate chips melted for the pads. When I was a kid, she made them for me if I was sad or if she felt guilty about something, which wasn't often. She must have felt bad about our argument. That was really thoughtful, Mom. I've missed these. She didn't say anything, just stood there with her eyes darting around my house. Then she wandered over to finger the dry leaves of the fern on my mantle. Before she could critique my plant mothering skills, I said, I don't know if you want to be around me. I have a cold, but if you want to stay, I could make us some tea.
You're sick? Why didn't you say something?
She perked up like she'd just won the mother lottery.
When Wayne comes back, we'll drive you to my doctor's. Where's your phone? I'll call their office right now.
I've had enough of doctors. Shit, I sounded like the freak. Look, if I decide I need one, I can drive myself, but it doesn't matter anyway. We're not going to get an appointment this late in the day.
That's ridiculous. Of course my doctor will see you.
My whole life, Mom has never thought she should have to wait for anything. Not doctor's appointments, tables in restaurants, supermarket lines. And sure as shit, she generally ends up with an appointment within the hour, the best table, and the store manager opening the next checkout for her. Mom, stop. I'm fine. There's nothing a doctor can do for a cold. I held up my hand as she opened her mouth to interrupt. But I promise if I get sicker, I'll go. She sighed, set her purse and package down on my end table, and patted the couch.
Why don't you lie down and I'll make you a hot lemon tea with honey?
Telling her I was capable of boiling my own water would just get me a look, so I collapsed on the couch. Sure, it's above the stove. Once she'd brought me a steaming mug, a plate of Annie Bear cookies, and poured herself a healthy glass of the red wine I had in the kitchen, she sat at the end of the couch and spread my throw over the both of us. She took a good long gulp of the wine, handed me the package, and said,
I found that photo album you were talking about. It must have gotten mixed up with our stuff somehow.
Sure it did, but I let it go. She'd brought the pictures back, and the hot tea was spreading a pleasant glow throughout my body, and even my feet felt warm, tucked against her leg. As I started to flip through the album, Mom took out an envelope from her purse and handed it to me.
You didn't have these photos, so I made you copies.
Surprised at the unexpected gesture, I focused on the first one. She and Daisy were at one of the ice rinks in town, wearing matching outfits, matching ponytails and matching skates. Daisy looked about 15, so it was probably taken just before the accident, and in the pink sparkly costume, Mom looked about the same age. I'd forgotten she skated with Daisy sometimes when she was practicing.
People used to tell me all the time that we could be sisters, she said.
I wanted to say, really? I don't see it at all.
You were prettier. Annie, your sister was gorgeous.
I looked at her face. Her eyes were shining and I knew she was pleased, but I also knew she agreed with me. While she got up to get herself more wine, I flipped through the rest of the photos, and as she settled back down at my feet with a full glass, this time she brought the half-empty bottle with her and set it on the end table. I stopped at the last one, of Dad and her on their wedding day. When I glanced over at her, she was staring into her glass. It may have just been a trick of the light, but her eyes looked moist. Your dress was beautiful. I looked down at its sweetheart neckline, at the long beaded veil in her blonde hair, then back up from the photo. Leaning toward me, she said,
I made it from a pattern Val wanted for her own wedding dress one day. I told her she didn't have the chest for it.
Mom laughed.
Can you believe she's never forgiven me for that or for going out with your father?
She shrugged.
Like it was my fault he liked me more.
This was news. Aunt Val dated Dad?
They only went out a few times, but I suppose she thought they were something. She was just awful at the wedding, barely spoke to me. Did I tell you about our cake? It was three layers, and...
While Mom went step by step through their wedding feast, the details of which I'd heard a million times, I thought about Aunt Val. No wonder she was always trying to get back at Mom. Might also explain her attitude toward Daisy and me. When we were kids, she and Mom did the take each other's kids for the weekend thing, which Daisy and I dreaded. Aunt Val mostly ignored me, but I swear she actually hated Daisy, looking for any reason to make fun of her while Tamara and her brother giggled. Our families didn't do a lot together after the accident. Wayne and Uncle Mark don't have much in common, or even like each other, so it was mostly just Aunt Val and Mom. When they did include us kids, my cousin Jason teased the hell out of me, but Tamara kept her distance. I thought she was stuck up. Now I figure her mother was probably giving her the gears about me as much as mine was about her. One afternoon after I moved into my house, Mom and Aunt Val popped in from a shopping trip. Aunt Val glanced around, then asked me how I was enjoying real estate. It's good, I like the challenge.
Yes, Tamara seems to really thrive on it, too. She got the top sales award for her office this quarter, won a bottle of Dom Perignon and a weekend trip to Whistler. Does your office ever do anything like that, Annie?
Nice dig, if not subtle. My office was large for Clayton Falls, but nowhere near the size of Tamara's downtown Vancouver firm. We'd be lucky to get a bottle of wine and a plastic plaque.
Before I could answer, Mom said, "Oh, she's still doing residential? Annie's getting a huge project, all waterfront units. Didn't you say it was going to be the largest building in Clayton Falls, Annie Bear?"
I'd only been talking to a developer, hadn't even done a presentation yet, which Mom well knew, but she just enjoyed twisting the knife so much I didn't have the heart to take it out of her hand. I said, "It's a big one."
"I'm sure Tamara will get a project one day too, Val. Maybe Annie can give her some tips?"
Mom smiled at Aunt Val, who looked like her tea had just turned to poison in her mouth. Of course, Aunt Val rallied.
"That's a lovely offer, but right now Tamara is finding she can make more money selling houses and doesn't want to spend years marketing a project that may not even sell. But I'm sure Annie will be fabulous at it."
Mom's face turned so red I was actually worried for a minute, but she managed to force a smile and changed the subject. God only knows what those two were like growing up. Mom never talks about her childhood much, but I know her dad split when she was pretty young and her mom remarried another deadbeat. Her older stepbrother, Dwight, is the one who's in prison. He robbed a bank when he was 19, just before Mom got married, served his sentence and was released a month after the accident, then managed to get arrested a week later. Dumbass even shot a guard in the leg the last time. I've never met him, and Mom refuses to talk about him. I made the mistake of asking if we could go see him once, and she flipped out.
"Don't you even think about going near that man."
When I said, "But Tamara told me Aunt Val takes them, so why can't we?" That got me a slammed door. After we moved into the shitty rental house, I came home from school one day to find Mom sitting on the couch, staring at a letter in her hands with a half-empty bottle of vodka beside her. It looked like she'd been crying. I said, "What's wrong, Mom?" She just kept staring at the letter. "Mom?" Her voice was desperate.
"I won't let it happen again. I won't."
A jolt of fear shot through me.
"What? What won't you let happen?"
She held a lighter to the letter and dropped it in the ashtray. When it was gone, she picked up the bottle and stumbled to her room. On the kitchen table, I found an envelope with a prison as its return address. The envelope was gone by the morning, but she didn't leave the house for a week after that. I tuned back in when Mom said,
"You know, Luke's a lot like your father."
"You think?" "I guess in some ways. He's patient like Dad was, that's for sure. We've been talking a lot recently. I'm going to help him with his bookkeeping."
"Bookkeeping?"
She said the word like I'd just announced I was going to become a prostitute.
"You hate bookkeeping."
I shrugged. "I need to make some money."
"So you haven't talked to an agent or a producer?"
"I decided I don't want to make more money off what happened to me. It makes me sick that people, including me, have made any money off it at all." The first time I saw an old high school friend being interviewed on TV, I sat stunned on my couch while this girl I hadn't seen in a decade told the talk show host about the first time we tried pot, about the outdoor party where I got drunk and threw up in the back seat of a car belonging to a boy I had a major crush on, then read aloud from notes we supposedly passed each other in class. That wasn't even the worst of it. The guy I lost my virginity to sold his story to a major men's magazine. Jerk even gave them pictures of us from when we were together. One of them was of me in a bikini.
Mom said, "Annie, you really need to think about this. You don't have the luxury of time."
Her face was concerned.
"You never went to college or university. Sales is just about all you can do, but try selling anything now. All people see when they look at you is a rape victim. And bookkeeping for Luke, how long is that going to last?"
I remembered a call a few days back from a movie producer. Before I could hang up on her, she said, "I know you must be sick of people bothering you, but I promise, if you just take a few minutes to hear me out and you still say no, I'll never call again." Something about her no-bullshit tone of voice connected with me, so I told her to go ahead. She gave me her pitch on how I could set the record straight and my story could benefit women all over the world. Then she said,
What's holding you back? Maybe if you tell me what you're afraid of, I can see what we could do.
Sorry, you can talk, but sharing my reasons wasn't part of the bargain. So she talked, and it was like she knew exactly what I was worried about and what I wanted to hear. She even told me I could have final script and actor approval, and she said the money could set me up for life. I said, "It's still a no, but if anything changes, I'll call you first." "I hope you do, but I hope you also understand that there's a time limit to this offer." She was right, and Mom was right. If I waited much longer, I was going to be a hell of a lot more than a day late and a dollar short. But I wasn't sure what was worse, going down in a ball of flames like Mom predicted, or actually taking her advice. Mom looked away from the TV and took another slug of wine. I said, "Did you give a movie producer my number?" She paused with her glass in midair and her forehead wrinkled.
"Did someone call you?"
"Yeah, that's why I'm asking. My number's unlisted." She shrugged.
"Those people have ways."
"Don't talk to any of them, Mom, please." We held eyes for a moment. Then she let her head fall to rest on the back of my couch.
"I know I was hard on you girls, but it was only because I wanted more for you than I'd had."
I waited for her to say more, but she just gestured to the TV with her hand holding the glass.
"Do you remember when I let you and Daisy stay up late to watch that?"
Now I realized she'd been staring at a preview for Gone with the Wind, one of her favorite movies. "Sure, you stayed up with us and we all slept in the living room." She smiled at the memory, but her face was sad. It turned thoughtful as she turned to look at me.
"It's on in an hour. I could stay over tonight if you're sick."
"Oh, I don't know. I've been getting up around 7 and going for a run. She turned back to the TV. The sudden withdrawal of her attention hurt more than I care to admit. "Okay, sure, it might be nice to have some company. Probably stupid to run feeling like this anyway." She gave me a smile and patted my foot under the blanket.
"Then I'll stay, Annie Bear."
She dragged the cushions off the other couch and started building a bed in the middle of the living room floor. When she asked me where I kept my spare blankets, her cheeks pink with excitement, I figured what the hell. Beats another night lying awake in the hall closet thinking, why didn't the burglar take anything? Later that night, after Mom sent Wayne home when he stopped by to pick her up, after we'd eaten popcorn, Annie Bear cookies, and ice cream while watching Gone with the Wind, Mom passed out with her small body pressed against my back and her knees tucked into the curve of mine. As her breath tickled my back and her arm lay over me, I stared at her tiny hand touching my skin and realized it was the first time I'd let anyone physically close to me since I came back from the mountain. I turned my face away so she wouldn't feel my tears against her arm. "Just thinking, Doc, every time I say something bad about Mom, I have this urge to list all her good qualities right after. My version of knocking on wood. And the thing is, Mom isn't all bad, but that's the problem. It would be easier if I could just hate her, because it's the rare times when she's loving that make the other times so much harder." Session 18. On my way to your office, I walked by a bulletin board and a concert poster caught my eye. I was checking out the announcement, just about to take a sip of my coffee, when I noticed part of a different flyer underneath the poster. Something about it seemed familiar, so I pulled it out, and holy shit, Doc, it was a flyer with my face on it. My face. Over the words, "Missing Realtor." I just kept staring, and until a drop landed on my hand, I wasn't even aware I was crying. Maybe I should put up my own flyers. Still missing. That smiling face belonged to the woman I used to be, not the woman I am now. Luke must have given them the photo. He snapped it on our first Christmas morning together. He'd just handed me a beautiful card, and I was grinning up at him all happy and shit. My hand shook like I was holding ice instead of warm coffee. The flyer is stuffed in the garbage can outside your office now, but I still have the urge to go back and pull it out. God knows what I'd do with it. Now that the shock of seeing my picture's worn off, I really want to talk about what happened when I finally sat down and made a list of all the people in my life like you suggested. Yes, Fräulein Freud, I actually gave one of your ideas a whirl. Shit, I had to do something. Couldn't keep sitting around freaking myself out over the break-in. My internal scare-yourself-silly soundtrack goes a little something like this. My car was in the driveway, so the burglar must have seen me leave with Emma. How long had he been watching the house? Days? Week? Months? Still? What if it wasn't a burglar? Then I spend the next hour telling myself I'm an idiot. The cops are right, it was just a random event. A stupid burglar who got freaked by the alarm. But then the whispers start up again. Someone's watching you right now. The second you relax, he's going to get you. You can't trust anyone. Like I said, I had to do something. Starting with the ones closest to me. Luke, Christina, Mom, Wayne. Any family like Tamara, her brother Jason, Aunt Val, and her husband Mark. I made a column beside each one for any reasons they might want to hurt me. Feeling like a complete idiot because, of course, there's nothing to put there. Next, I moved down the list to anyone else I might have pissed off. Former clients, co-workers, ex-boyfriends. I've never been sued. The only realtor who might have had an issue with me is the mystery realtor competing against me for that project back when I was abducted. And although I've broken the odd heart, I never did anything deserving of revenge so long after the fact. Even wrote down the names of a couple of Luke's exes. One was still hung up on him when we started dating, but hell, she moved to Europe before I was even abducted. I put the freak down, too. Then wrote dead by his name. I sat at my table, staring at this ridiculous list with its got a listing they wanted, didn't return their call, didn't sell their house fast enough, kept one of his CDs, notes in the column. And when I tried to imagine any of these people lurking outside my house or breaking in so they could get me, I shook my head at my craziness. Of course it was just a burglar, probably some junky teenager looking to buy his next fix, and he's not going to come back now that he knows I have an alarm. Man, as silly as I felt making that list, I'm glad I did it. Even got a good night's sleep in my bed that night. By the time Luke came over Saturday afternoon to set up that bookkeeping software, I was as ready as I was ever going to be. Aiming for casual but not sloppy, I'd rummaged through the box of clothes from Christina and found some beige cargo pants and a periwinkle blue t-shirt. Part of me wanted to throw on a jogging suit and mess up my house again, but when I looked in the mirror, I didn't mind what I saw. I still haven't gotten around to having my hair cut, so I just washed it and pulled it back. I finally gained a bit of weight. Never thought I'd think that was a good thing. My face has filled out. I debated putting on makeup. Mom brought me a bag of cosmetics in the hospital, but none of it was colors or brands I like. Anyway, even if I hadn't heard the freak's voice telling me makeup is for whores, I couldn't bring myself to call that much attention to my face. I settled for moisturizer, light pink lip balm, and mascara. I probably didn't look as good as the old days, but I definitely looked worse. Luke, however, looked amazing when I answered his knock. He must have just come from work, because he wore black dress pants and a burnt orange shirt that set off his warm olive skin and the amber flecks in his brown eyes. Emma rolled over and wriggled at his feet. I answered his, "Hi," with a barely audible one of my own, then stepped back so he could come in. We stood awkwardly in my foyer. He raised an arm as though he was going to touch me or pull me in for a hug, then let it drop. Considering my reaction the last two times he tried to touch me, I wasn't surprised. He crouched down to pet Emma. "She's looking great, huh? I thought about bringing Diesel over, but I didn't know if that'd be too much chaos." I told the top of his head, "I'm not an invalid." "Never said you were." Still crouched, he looked up and met my eyes with a smile. "So, should we have a look at this program? And by the way, you're looking great yourself." I stared at him while my cheeks grew warm. A grin spread across his face. I twisted around so fast I almost tripped on Emma and said, "Let's go down to my office." The next hour whipped by as he showed me how to set up the program and we went through the system together. I enjoyed learning something new and was glad we had something to focus on besides each other. I was having a hard enough time adjusting to him sitting next to me. He was in the middle of explaining a section when I blurted out, "That time you noticed me leaving the store, I saw you with a girl. That's why I was in such a hurry." "Annie, And when you saw me in the hospital, you were so fucking kind. With those flowers and that stuffed golden retriever, but I just couldn't deal. With you, with anything." "After that, I asked the nurses to tell you I was only allowed visits from family and the police. And I hate that I did that. It was so nice of you. You're always so nice, and I'm such a..." "Annie, the day you were abducted, I was late for dinner." "Well, that was news." "The restaurant got busy, and I lost track of time. I didn't even call when your open house ended like I usually did. And when I finally called on my way to your house a half hour late and you didn't pick up, I just thought you were mad. And when your car wasn't there, I assumed you got stuck with your clients, so I went home to wait. It wasn't until you still hadn't returned my calls an hour later that I finally headed over to where you said you were doing the open house. He took a deep breath. God, when I saw your car in the driveway, then all your things just lying there on the counter. I called your mom right away.
Turns out it was Mom who got the cops to take things seriously. She met Luke at the police station, convinced the desk sergeant I would never stand my boyfriend up, and was at the house when the cops found my purse in a closet, where I always put it for safekeeping. Since there weren't any signs of a struggle, Luke was their main suspect in the beginning. After a few weeks, I started drinking at the restaurant almost every night after work.
But you hardly ever...
I did a lot of dumb things then. Things I never would have done. I wondered what dumb things he was talking about. But he looked so awkward and red-faced, I said, "Don't beat yourself up. You handled it better than I probably would have."
"Are you still drinking a lot?"
After a few months, I knew I was relying on the buzz, so I quit. By then, most people thought you were dead. I didn't feel like you were, but everyone was acting like you'd never be found. And a lot of the time, I was angry at you. I knew it was irrational, but in a way, I blamed you. I never told you this, but I didn't like you doing open houses. That's why I usually called you after. You were so friendly. Men can take that the wrong way.
But that was my job, Luke. You're friendly at the restaurant.
I'm a guy, though. And look, I had stuff I had to work out for myself. I went a little crazy.
Emma butted her head between us and broke the tension. We gave her a few strokes. Then I asked her where her ball was, and she took off.
I went out with the girl you saw a couple of times, but I ended up talking about you and the case, so I knew I wasn't ready. What I'm trying to say, Annie, is that I'm just as confused as you, and that we've both changed. But I do know I still care about you. Still like being with you. I just wish I could help you more. You used to tell me how safe you felt with me.
He gave a sad smile. I did feel safe with you. But now no one can make me feel safe. I have to get there on my own. He nodded.
I can understand that.
Good. Now can you help me understand this damn program of yours? He laughed. About 20 minutes later, we were done, and just as I was debating whether to invite him to stay for dinner, he said he should get back to the restaurant. At the door, he stepped toward me, hesitated for a second, then raised his eyebrows and, just slightly, his arms. I moved toward him and he folded me into a hug. For a minute, I felt trapped and wanted to wrench free, but I buried my nose in his shirt and inhaled the aroma of his restaurant. Oregano, baked bread, garlic. He smelled like long dinners with friends, like too much wine and laughter, like happiness. Against my hair, he murmured,
"It was really good to see you, Annie."
I nodded, and as we slowly pulled apart, I kept my eyes down until I'd blinked back the tears. Later, I wondered if he would have stayed for dinner if I'd asked, but my regret was balanced with relief over not having to hear him say no. I used to be so good at quick decisions. But ever since I killed the freak, I've lived in perpetual hesitation. I remember reading once that if you have a bird that's lived in a cage for a long time and you leave the cage door open, the bird won't leave right away. I never understood that before. I'd fallen asleep on the bed where I'd collapsed after killing the freak, and the throbbing of my breasts woke me. My milk was still drying up. My first awareness was of the keys gripped in my hand. I'd held them so tight while I slept that they'd left marks in my skin. In my sleepy confusion over why I had the keys and fear that the freak would catch me with them, I let go. The jingle they made falling onto the bed startled me out of my haze. He was dead. I'd killed him. My bladder urged me to the bathroom, but I checked the watch and saw I had 10 minutes to wait. When I tried to go anyway, my bladder froze. 10 minutes later, no problem. On my way back to the bed, my leg brushed the baby's blanket on her basket. I picked it up and pressed my face into it, breathing in the last traces of her scent. My daughter was still out there, alone. I had to find her. I pulled on a white dress and stuffed my bra with cloth dampened with cold water for breast pads. After grabbing some slippers, I headed back down to the river and searched its shores in either direction until trees or sheer cliffs blocked my path. From a distance, any pale boulders the size of a baby stopped my breath until I was close. A bundle of cloth snagged on a tree in the middle of the river had my knees wobbling until I waded out and realized it was nothing but rags. When I wasn't able to find any trace of her there, I examined the clearing inch by inch for any signs of disturbed earth, but I couldn't find a thing. I even dug my hands through the soft garden dirt surrounding the cabin. I wouldn't have put it past the sick bastard to bury her where we planted food, and crawled under the porch. Nothing. The only place I hadn't searched yet was the shed. The summer sun had been beating down on the metal shed all morning, and as the door opened, the odor of his already decomposing body rushed toward me in a nauseating wave. I grabbed a gasoline-scented rag off the bench and held it against the bottom of my face. Then, concentrating on breathing through my mouth, I tiptoed past his body. Flies that had hitched a ride in with his corpse the day before hummed around the tarp, as loud as the generator. With trembling hands, I dug everything out of the freezer. She wasn't in there, and the shelves held nothing but lanterns, batteries, kerosene, and ropes. I found a trapdoor with stairs to a root cellar, its dank scent fresh compared to the stench of death above. All it contained was canned foods, household items, a first aid kit, some boxes, and in an old coffee can a roll of money with a pink hair elastic wrapped around it. I hoped the elastic didn't belong to another girl who'd been hurt. It wasn't a lot of money, so I figured he had more stashed elsewhere. His wallet still hadn't shown up. Not in his pocket when I grabbed the keys, or in any of the cupboards in the cabin, but I'd never seen him with one. One of the keys hadn't fit any locks yet, and I hoped it was for the van, hidden somewhere, his wallet inside. In a wooden crate, I discovered a rifle, a handgun, and ammo. I stared down at them. I'd never really seen the gun he threatened me with the first day, only felt it in my back and saw the butt of it in his waistband. It looked small next to the rifle, but I hated them both. One had killed the duck, and one had forced me into this hell. My hand moved for just a second to the spot on my lower back where it had been pressed. I closed the crate and shoved it behind some others. Each time I opened a box, I was afraid I might discover my baby's body shoved inside, something that needed to be stored away and neatly labeled practice. But the final box only held my yellow suit and all my photos and newspaper ads. When I opened it, I caught a trace of my perfume, and I pressed the soft material against my nose. I tried the blazer on over my dress, but it felt wrong to wear it, like I'd put on a dead girl's clothes. I left the suit in the box and only took the photo of me I thought was from my office as I headed back up and out into the light. The only area I hadn't searched was the surrounding forest, so after I drank some cold water, I stuffed an old pack sack I'd found in the cellar with protein bars, the first aid kit, and a thermos of water. I was about to head out when I spotted the photo on the counter next to my baby's blanket and one of her sleepers. I added them all to my pack sack of treasures. Soon after I stepped into the forest on the right side of the cabin, the steady rush of the river and the chirp of the birds that usually clustered in the clearing faded, and the only sounds were my footsteps muffled by the blanket of fir needles covering the ground. I spent the rest of the afternoon climbing over and under dead logs, digging at every slight mound, and sniffing the air for any trace of rot. I never went into the woods any deeper than 15 minutes from the cabin, and worked my way toward the highest point of the clearing in a sweeping radius. When I finally made it to the top, I discovered a narrow trail at the edge of the woods heading into the forest. Crowded with salal and lady ferns, it was a vague line discernible only by the odd faded machete mark on the tree trunks. Some of the trees, Douglas firs reaching higher than I could see, were a couple of feet around, and their trunks were blanketed in moss, which meant it was a moist forest. I was probably still on Vancouver Island. I looked back at the clearing one final time and prayed that if there was a heaven, and I've never wanted to believe more than in that moment, Then my baby was with my dad and Daisy. As I headed down the trail, I spotted a possible break in the tree line in the distance, and after another 5 minutes, I stepped out of the woods onto an old gravel road. Judging by the potholes and lack of tire tracks, it hadn't been used for a while. About 10 feet down, the bank dipped in slightly on the right. Moving toward it, I realized the dip was the start of a smaller road veering off the main one. The freak would have had to hide the van close to the cabin, so I decided to follow it. Not much wider than a truck, it was covered in grass, and if you were driving by, you probably wouldn't even notice it. It curved around to run parallel to the main road, about 20 feet of trees between the two. Farther down the road, I came across a small white bone, and my feet stopped along with my heart. I scanned the ground inch by inch, then found a bone too large for my baby, and within a few feet I nearly stumbled on the skeleton of a deer. I followed the road until it ended in a wall of dead broom bush and branches. At the bottom, a piece of metal glinted in the sun. With frantic hands, I ripped the vegetation away. I was staring at the back of a van. A quick search of the glove box turned up no wallet or registration papers, not even a map. Peering between the seats into the dim back of the van, I noticed some material wadded into a ball and reached for it. It was the gray blanket, the one he used to abduct me. The sensation of the rough wool in my hand combined with the scent of the van was all too familiar. I dropped the blanket like it was on fire and flipped around in the seat. Trying not to think about what had happened in the back, I focused on turning the key in the ignition. Nothing. I held my breath. Please start, please start. And tried the key again. Nothing. My body dripped with sweat in the sweltering van, and my legs stuck to the vinyl seats where my dress had ridden up. With my forehead against the hot steering wheel, I took a few calming breaths and popped the hood. I spotted the disconnected battery cable right away, tightened it back up, and gave the engine another try. This time it came to life immediately, and the radio began to blast country music. It had been so long since I'd heard music that I laughed. When the DJ came on, I caught the words, "Back to a commercial-free hour," but no clue to where I was, and when I tried to find another station, the knob just spun around. I threw the van in reverse, backed down the little road, ran right over some saplings, and shot out onto the main road. It hadn't been graded for a while, so I took my time coming down the mountain. After about a half hour, my tires hit pavement, and maybe 20 minutes later, the road straightened out. Eventually, my nose caught the familiar scent of ocean air tinged with the sulfur from a pulp mill, and I came into a small town. Stopped at a red light, I noticed a coffee shop on my left. The smell of bacon drifted through my open window, and I inhaled the aroma with longing. The freak never let me have bacon, said it would make me fat. My mouth filled with saliva as I watched an old guy sitting near the window pop a piece of bacon into his mouth, chew quickly, then shove another one in. I wanted bacon. A plateful, nothing else, just strips and strips of bacon. Then I'd chew each piece slowly, savoring the salty yet slightly sweet juices every crunch released. A big bacon fuck you to the freak. The old guy wiped his greasy hands on the shoulder of his shirt. The freak whispered in my head, "You don't want to be a pig, do you, Annie?" I looked away. Across the street was a cop shop. Session 19. Hope you're feeling better this week, Doc. Guess I can't give you a hard time for canceling our last session, considering I was probably the one who gave you the cold. I'm feeling better myself about a lot of things. For starters, the cops called early this week to tell me they nabbed the guy who's been doing all the break-ins, and yep, it was just a teenager. You'll also be happy to hear I haven't slept in the closet since I last saw you, and I've stopped having a bath at night. Now I can shave my legs in the shower, and I don't even need to wash and condition my hair twice. I can pee over half the time without having to do any deep breathing, and I eat when I need to. Sometimes I don't even hear the freak's voice when I break one of his rules. Only thing that keeps nagging at me is that stupid photo the freak had of me, the older one. I hadn't thought about it once since I came home, too much other shit going on, But then after I mentioned it to you the other day, I came across it in a little box where I keep the stuff I brought home from the mountain during another of my many "that bastard must have stolen something" searches of my house. The real estate company where I worked had cubicles, and I kept a corkboard above my desk with lots of photos pinned to it, so I figured maybe the freak had snatched it from there. If he said he was looking for a house, he could have been in the office meeting with any of the realtors. That might even have been when he first saw me, for all I know. But why would I have had one of just myself up in my office? And why am I driving myself nuts trying to figure it out? It's not like it matters anymore. Hell, sometimes I think my mind just looks for shit to obsess about. It's like trying to put a group of kids to bed. One worry finally drifts off, and another is out and running. This week I was thinking about how in the past Christina and I would have gone over every minute of Luke's visit, analyzing it scene by scene, and I had a wave of missing her. Reminding myself how relieved I'd felt after I made my list, and how proud I'd been when I finally faced Luke, I dialed her cell before I could chicken out. Christina speaking. Hey, it's me. Annie, hang on a sec. I heard muffled sounds of Christina speaking to someone, then she came back on the line. Sorry, Annie, hectic morning, but I'm so glad you called. Shit, it's tour day, isn't it? You want me to call later? No way, lady, I'm not letting you off that easy. I've been waiting too long for you to pick up the phone. We both paused. Not knowing how to explain my avoidance of her and everyone else, I said, So, how have you been? Me? Same old, same old. And Drew? He's good, he's good. You know us, nothing ever changes. How are you doing? Okay, I guess. I searched my mind for something interesting in my life I could share. I'm doing some bookkeeping for Luke. You guys are talking again? Out came the fake Russian accent. Well, 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 that's good news. It's not like that, it's just a business thing, I said, quicker than I meant to. She gave her I know you're full of shit laugh, then said, If you say so. Hey, how's your mom doing? I saw her in Wayne downtown the other day and she was looking, pissed out of her mind. Seems to be the theme lately, but she did come over a couple of weeks ago to bring me back my photo album and some pictures of Dad and Daisy I'd never seen. That shocked the shit out of me. She thought she lost you. She's probably still trying to come to terms with it all. Yeah. I didn't feel like getting into it, so I said, I was wondering what my house is worth these days. Why? You're not thinking of selling, are you? Not wanting to talk about the break-in, I said, It's just not the same since Mom rented it out. Doesn't even smell like me anymore. I think you should give it some time before you... A voice said something to Christina in the background. Darn, my clients just arrived out front. We're already late, so I've got to run, but give me a call this evening, okay? I really want to talk to you. During and after the phone call, I missed Christina more than ever. And I did think about calling her that night. But her sign-off told me she was gearing up for another of her this-is-what-you-should-do talks, and I just couldn't deal with it. So when I heard the knock on my door Saturday afternoon and looked through the window to find Christina, who's always dressed to the nines, standing on my front porch wearing white overalls, a baseball cap, and a shit-eating grin, I didn't know what the hell to think. I opened the door and saw she was holding a couple of paintbrushes in one hand and a huge paint can in the other. She handed me a brush. Come on now, let's see what we can do about this house of yours. I'm kind of tired today. If you'd called... She blew right by, leaving me talking to my doorstep. Over her shoulder, she said, Oh, please, like you answer your phone. She had me there. Quit your whining and get your ass in gear, girl. She started pushing one end of my couch, and unless I wanted my hardwood floor damaged, I didn't have much choice but to join in moving all the crap out of my living room. I'd always wanted to paint the beige walls, but I'd never gotten around to it. When I saw the gorgeous creamy yellow she'd chosen, I was hooked. We painted for a couple of hours, then took a break and sat outside on my deck with a glass of red wine. Christina won't drink anything under $20 a bottle and always brings her own stuff. The sun had just gone down, so I turned all my patio lanterns on. We sat in silence for a few minutes, watching Emma chew her rawhide bone. Then Christina looked me straight in the eyes. So what happened between us? I played with the stem of my glass and shrugged. My face felt hot. I don't know, it's just...
Just what? I think if people are friends, they should be honest with each other. You're my best friend.
I'm trying, I just need...
Did you follow up on any of my suggestions, or did you block them out too? There's a book out now by a rape survivor you should read. It talks about how victims had to build up walls to survive, but then afterwards they can't...
It's that. The pressure. The endless, constant, you shoulds. I didn't want to talk about it, but you just couldn't let it go. When I tried to tell you I didn't want the clothes, you just steamrolled right over me. I stopped to take a breath. Christina looked stunned. You were trying to help, I get that, but man, Christina, sometimes you just have to back off.
We were both quiet for a minute. Then Christina said, Maybe if you explained why you didn't want the clothes?
I can't explain. That's the problem. And if you want to help, then you just have to accept me the way I am. Stop trying to make me talk about shit. Stop trying to fix me. If you can't do that, then we can't hang out.
I braced for fireworks, but Christina nodded a couple of times and said, Okay, I'll try it your way. I need you in my life, Annie.
Oh, I said. Well, good. I mean, that's great, because I want you in my life, too.
She smiled. Then her face turned serious. But there's something I have to tell you. A lot of things happened when you were away. Everyone was so emotional, and nobody knew how to handle it, and I held up a hand. Stop. We have to keep things light. It's the only way I can do this. But Annie...
No, no buts.
I had a feeling she wanted to tell me she got the project. I drove by her signs in front of it the other day. But the last thing I wanted to do was talk about real estate. Besides, it made sense that she got it, and I was happy for her. Hell, I'd way rather it be her than whoever I was competing against. She stared at me hard for a few seconds, then shook her head. All right, you win. But if you're not going to let me talk, then I'm going to make you paint some more. With a groan, I followed her back into the house, and we finished the rest of the living room. After we said our goodbyes on the porch and she was about to step into her BMW, she turned back. Annie, before, I was just being the same way with you as I've always been.
I know. But I'm not the same.
She said, None of us are.
And shut her door.
The next afternoon, I decided to go through a couple of boxes of my stuff I'd found in my mom's carport when I was borrowing some gardening tools. The first one was full of my real estate awards and plaques, which I put away in my office without hanging them. The second box, with all my old art supplies, drawings, and paintings, interested me much more. Tucked into the pages of my sketchbook was a brochure for an art school I'd forgotten I wanted to go to. For once, a trip down memory lane wasn't lined with screaming ghosts, and the smell of charcoal pencils and oil paints made me smile. I pulled out my sketch pad and the brochure, grabbed my pencils, poured myself a glass of Shiraz and headed for my deck. For a while, I just stared at a blank page. Emma was lying in one of the last rays of the setting sun, which made her coat glow and accentuated the shadows on her. With my pencil, I followed the curve of her body on the paper, and then it started coming back to me. Reveling in the sensation of my hand brushing against crisp paper, I watched my simple lines create a form, then smudged some of them with my fingertips for shading. I kept working at it, changing the balance of light and dark, then stopped to gaze for a few seconds at a bird whistling in a tree near me. When I focused back on my paper, I was startled. No, shocked. I'd glanced away from a drawing of a dog, but when I looked back, I saw Emma, right down to the little cowlick at the top of her tail. I sat there, enjoying my sketch for a few minutes, wishing I had someone to show it to. Then my attention turned to the brochure. As I flipped through it, I smiled at notes I'd made to myself. But my smile faded when I noticed I'd circled the tuition fee and put a big question mark beside it. Mom got a small inheritance when my grandma died, but when I asked about using some of it for school, she said it was all gone. Whatever was left when she hooked up with Wayne no doubt disappeared before the ink was dry on the marriage license. I thought about getting a part-time job to put myself through art school, but Mom kept telling me artists don't make any money, so I wasn't sure what to do, and I just started working. I figured once I'd saved up enough, I'd look into going to school, but it just never happened. When Luke called last night, I told him about my afternoon sketching.
That's great, Annie. You always liked art.
He didn't ask about seeing my drawing, and I didn't ask if he wanted to. Christina's come over a couple of times to help me paint the other walls in my house. She keeps it light, like I asked, but it feels strained in a way. Not tense, just odd. But the second I think about sharing anything that happened on the mountain, a massive wave of anxiety presses in on me. Right now, all I can handle is gossip about Hollywood stars and people we used to work with. The last time I saw her, she told me about this goofy cop who taught her self-defense class. Took me right back to the ones I had to deal with when I first got off the mountain. Let's just say, since my expectations were based on TV reruns, I was hoping for Lenny Briscoe, but I got Barney Fife. I was happy to see a woman behind the front desk of the cop shop, but she didn't even glance up from her crossword. Who are you looking for? A policeman, I guess.
You guess?
No, I mean, yes, I want to see a policeman. What I really wanted was to leave, but she waved over some guy who was just coming out of the men's room and wiping his hands on the legs of his uniform.
Constable Pepper will help you, she said.
It's a good thing his title wasn't sergeant. The guy already had enough to deal with. He was at least 6 feet tall and had a really big gut, but was skinny everywhere else. His gun belt looked like it was losing the fight to hang on to his narrow hips. He glanced at me, grabbed some files from the front desk, and said,
Come on.
He stopped to pour himself a cup of coffee from a beat-up coffee maker, didn't offer me any, and dumped sugar and creamer into the mug. He motioned for me to follow him past a glass-walled office and three cops in the main area crowded around a table with a small portable TV, watching a game. He pushed a stack of files to the side of his desk, set his coffee mug down, and waved me into the chair across from him. It took him a 2-minute rummage through his drawer to find a pen that worked, and another few were spent pulling out various forms and then shoving them back in. Finally, he was settled with a working pen and a form in front of him.
Your name, please?
Annie O'Sullivan. He looked straight at me, his eyes searching every angle of my face. Then he got up so fast he knocked over his coffee.
Stay here, I have to get someone.
Leaving the coffee soaking into his papers, he went into the glass office and started talking to a short, gray-haired guy I assumed was important because he had the only private office. Judging by his hands waving around, Pepper was pretty excited. When Pepper pointed to me, the older guy turned to look and our eyes met. I already had that get-out-of-here-now feeling. The cops near the television turned it down and looked back and forth between me and the office. When I glanced at the front desk, the woman there was watching me. I looked back at the office. The old guy picked up his phone and talked into it, pacing around as far as the cord would go. He hung up, pulled a file from a drawer behind him, and then he and Pepper looked in the file, talked to each other, stared at me, looked at the file again. Subtle these guys were not. Finally, the old guy and Pepper, carrying the file, left the office. The old guy leaned down close to me with one hand resting on his knee and the other stuck out. He spoke slowly and enunciated every word carefully.
Hello, my name is Sergeant Jablonski.
Annie O'Sullivan. I shook his outstretched hand. It was cool and dry.
Nice to meet you, Annie. We'd like to talk to you in private, if that's okay.
Why the hell was he dragging his words out? English isn't my second language, dumbass. I guess. I got to my feet. Grabbing a couple of legal pads and pens off his desk, Pepper said,
We're just going to take you to one of our interview rooms.
At least he was talking at a normal speed. As we walked away from the desk, all the cops in the room stood still. Pepper and Jablonski moved to stand on either side of me, and Pepper tried to hold my arm, but I pulled it back. You'd think I was being escorted to the electric chair. I swear the phones even stopped ringing. Pepper managed to suck in his gut slightly and walked with his shoulders back and chest puffed out like he'd hunted me down all by himself. It was definitely a small town. So far, I'd seen only a few cops, and the cold concrete room they led me into was the size of your average bathroom. Just as we sat down across from each other at a metal table, Pepper got up to answer a knock on the door. The woman from the front desk handed him two coffees and tried to peer around him, but he stepped in front of her and shut the door. The older guy nodded to me.
You want a coffee? A pop?
No, thanks.
One of the walls had a large mirror on it. I hated the idea of someone I couldn't see watching my every move. I pointed at the mirror. Is anybody there?
Not at this time, Jablonski said.
Did that mean there might be someone later? I nodded toward the upper left corner. What's the camera for?
We'll be audio and videotaping the interview. It's standard procedure.
That was just as bad as the mirror. I shook my head. You have to shut it off.
You'll forget it's even there. Are you Annie O'Sullivan from Clayton Falls?
I stared at the camera. Pepper cleared his throat. Jablonski repeated the question. The silence continued for another minute or so. Then Jablonski made a quick slicing motion across his neck. Pepper left the room for a couple of minutes, and by the time he came back, the little red light on the camera was off. Jablonski said,
We have to leave the audio recorder on. We can't conduct an interview without it.
I wondered if he was bullshitting. On the TV shows, sometimes they use one, sometimes they don't. But I let it go.
Let's try this again. Are you Annie O'Sullivan from Clayton Falls?
Yes. Am I on Vancouver Island?
You don't know?
That's why I'm asking. Jablonski said,
Yes, you're on the island.
His slow, precise speech disappeared with the next question.
Why don't you start off by telling us where you've been?
I don't know, other than that it was a cabin. I don't know how I got there because I was doing an open house and a guy...
What guy?
Pepper said.
Did you know this man?
Jablonski said. As the two spoke, at the same time, I flashed to the freak stepping out of the van and turning toward the house. He was a stranger. I was almost done with the open house and I went outside to...
What was he driving?
A van. I saw the freak smiling at me. Such a nice smile. My stomach clenched.
What color was it? Do you remember the make and model? Had you seen this van before?
No. I started counting the blocks on the concrete wall behind them.
You don't remember the make and model, or no, you hadn't seen it before?
It's a Dodge Caravan, I think. Tan and newer, that's all I know. The guy had the real estate paper. He had been watching me and he knew stuff.
He wasn't a past client or maybe some guy you turned down in a bar one night or chatted with on the internet?
Jablonski said. No, no, and no.
He raised his eyebrows. So let me get this straight. You're trying to tell us this guy picked you out of thin air?
I'm not trying to tell you anything. I don't know why he picked me.
We want to help you, Annie, but first we need the truth.
He leaned back in his chair and crossed his arms over his chest. My arms shot across the table and sent their stupid little pad of paper and coffees flying. I stood up, leaned over the table with both of my hands flat on it, and screamed into their shocked faces.
I am telling the truth!
Pepper held out both of his hands.
Take it easy, you're getting all worked up here.
I flipped the table over on its side. As they tried to get out of my way and scurry out the door, I yelled at their backs.
I'm not saying another damn word until you get me some real cops.
After they left me alone in the room, I stared at the mess in shock. I'd even broken one of their mugs. I righted the table, picked up the notepad, and tried to wipe up the coffee with some of the paper. After a few minutes, Pepper slunk in and grabbed the notepad off the table. One palm held out in front of him and the other clutching the notepad to his chest, he slowly backed out of the room.
Just relax, we have some people coming in to talk to you.
The front of his pants was wet with coffee from when I'd knocked the table over. I was about to hand him the broken pieces of mug and apologize, but he was through the door in a flash. I laughed for a couple of seconds, then put my forehead down on the table and cried. Session 20. Not sure if you saw the article in the paper this weekend, Doc, but they recovered some stolen goods from a shed on that teenager's property. Well, actually, the parents' property. Anyway, I called the cop who handled my break-in, wondering if anything was mine, but he said everything was accounted for. Later, I remembered something else the article said, that all the robberies occurred at night. So why would a burglar, especially a teenage burglar, change his pattern just to break into my house? He had to have timed it perfectly to know exactly when I went for my run, but then he didn't take anything. I started thinking about how the freak timed his abduction of me, arriving at the end of the open house on a hot summer day when he knew things would be slow. The freak who said the cabin hadn't been easy to set up. The freak who might have needed help. What if he had a partner? He could have had a friend, or for all I know, a freaky brother who was pissed off that I killed him. I just assumed the person who broke into my house saw me leave. But what if he thought I was home? My car was in the driveway, and it was pretty early. But why come for me after all this time? By Monday, I was so obsessed by the idea, I decided to call Gary and ask him if there was any chance the freak had some help. This crap is like cancer. If you don't get every last thread and cell of it, then it'll grow back into an even bigger tumor. But his phone was off, and when I called the station, they said he was away until this weekend. I was surprised he hadn't told me he was going away, since we generally talk a couple of times a week. He's always friendly when I call, never says anything stupid like, "What can I do for you?" Luckily, since I'm not always sure why I phone him. In the beginning, it wasn't even a conscious choice. Everything in my world would feel like it was spinning out of control, and then the phone's in my hand. Sometimes I couldn't even speak. Good thing there's caller ID. He'd wait a couple of seconds, and if I was still quiet, he'd start talking about the case until he ran out of new information. Then he'd tell me funny cop stories until I felt better and hung up, sometimes without even saying goodbye. One day, he was reduced to describing the proper way to clean a gun before I finally let him go. Can't believe the guy kept answering. Our conversations have been dialogue instead of mostly monologues for a few months now, but he never reveals anything personal, and something about him stops me from pressing. That's probably why he's away, something to do with his personal life. Guess cops have those, too. The cops I fired left me in that room by myself for a couple of hours, long enough for me to count every concrete block more than a few times, and I wondered whether they'd called my family and who was coming to talk to me. I took the pack sack off and held it on my lap, stroking its rough fabric. Somehow the motion was comforting. None of those meatheads bothered to ask if I needed to use the ladies' room, and it's a good thing I was trained to hold it, because it never occurred to me to just get up and leave. Eventually, the door opened, and a man and a woman walked in, both wearing serious expressions and dark suits. A very good suit in the man's case. His short hair, more salt than pepper, had me figuring him for early 50s, but his face looked more like he was in his 40s. He was over 6 feet for sure, and the way he held his shoulders squared and his back straight told me he was proud of his height. He looked solid. Calm. If this guy had been on the Titanic, he'd have finished his coffee. He met my gaze and walked toward me with a smooth, unhurried gait, and his hand held out. "Hello, Annie. I'm Staff Sergeant Kincaid with the Clayton Falls Serious Crime Unit." Nothing about this guy said Clayton Falls, and I had no idea what a staff sergeant was, but it clearly was a step up from Jablonski and his sidekick. His grip was strong, and as his hand slid out of mine, I felt calluses, and for some reason was relieved. The woman waiting just inside the doorway now walked briskly toward me. She was slightly plump with huge boobs, I'd say somewhere in her late 50s, but she carried her curves well in her skirt and blazer. Her hair was cut short and neat, and I was willing to bet she rinses out her pantyhose every night and always wears a full support bra. She shook my hand, smiled, and with a hint of a Quebec accent said, "I'm Corporal Bouchard. It's really good to finally meet you, Annie." They sat down across from me. The staff sergeant's eyes turned toward the doorway where the old guy was trying to wrestle a third chair in.
"We'll take it from here," Kincaid said.
Jablonski paused in the doorway with the chair.
"Some coffee would be great."
Kincaid turned back toward me. I swallowed a smile, the closest I'd come to one since my baby died. They had called me by my first name, like we were buddies, but they hadn't given me theirs. "Can I have your business cards, please?" I said. The two looked at each other. The guy held eyes with me for a second, then slid his card across the table. She followed suit. His first name was Gary and hers, Diane. Gary spoke first.
"So, Annie, like I said, we're both members of the Serious Crime Unit in Clayton Falls, and I was the lead investigator in your case."
Fat lot of good that did me.
You don't look like you're from Clayton Falls, I said.
One eyebrow rose.
Don't I?
When I didn't respond, he said,
A physician will be here shortly. He'll wanna...
I don't need a doctor. We held eyes for a moment. He launched into general questions like my birth date, address, job, things like that. The tension in my shoulders eased. He started to lead into the day I was taken, then stopped.
Do you mind if we turn the video recorder back on, Annie?
Yes, Gary. The way he kept using my first name reminded me of the freak. And I don't want anyone behind that mirror either.
I didn't mean to upset you.
His chin down and his head tilted to the side, he looked up at me with blue-gray eyes.
But it would make my job a lot easier, Annie.
Nice manipulation. But seeing as how I had just done his job by finding my own way back, I wasn't inclined to help him out any further. They were both silent as they waited for me to agree, but I said nothing.
Annie, what were you doing on August 4th of last year?
I couldn't remember the date I was taken. I don't know, Gary. If you're asking about the day I disappeared, I was doing an open house. It was a Sunday, and it was the first weekend of the month. I guess you'll have to figure it out from there yourself.
Would you prefer I not use your first name?
Caught off guard by his respectful tone of voice, I searched his face for signs he was messing with me. All I found was sincerity, which left me wondering if it was just a trick to gain my trust, or whether he actually gave a shit. It's fine, I said.
What's your mother's middle name, Annie?
She doesn't have one. Leaning across the table, I said in an exaggerated whisper, Did I pass the test yet? I understood his need for verification, but shit. They had pictures, and I'm pretty sure I didn't look like a girl who'd just had a great year. I was skin and bones with ratty hair and wearing a sweat-stained dress. He finally got around to straight out asking me what happened. I said the freak grabbed me at the open house. I used his real name, though, or at least the one he'd given me. I was going to explain more, but Gary jumped back in.
Where is he now?
He's dead. They both stared at me intently, but I wasn't going any further until he answered some of my questions. Where's my family?
We called your mother. She'll be here tomorrow, Gary said.
I started to tear up at the thought of seeing my mom again, so I stared down at the pack sack and counted the lines in its fabric. But why wasn't she here now? It had been hours since I walked into the joint. How much of a drive was it? It hadn't taken these guys that long. I want to know where I am.
I'm sorry, Gary said. I thought you knew you were in Port Northfield.
Can you show me on a map? Gary nodded to Diane, who left the room. When she brought a map back, he pointed out a town northwest of Clayton Falls, about 3/4 of the way up the island and right on the west coast. The roads to any of the towns off the beaten track were usually pretty rough, and you had to drive slowly. I calculated at least a 4-hour drive from Clayton Falls.
How did you guys get here so fast? Helicopter, Gary said.
Seeing that sucker fly in must have got this town all a-twitter. So I was right. I was never that far from home. I stared at Gary's finger resting on the dot for Port Northfield and blinked back my tears.
How did you get here?
Gary asked. I drove.
Where did you drive from?
His fingers tapped on the table. A cabin on a mountain.
How long were you driving for, Annie?
About an hour. He nodded and showed me a mountain on the map, near the dot for the town.
Is this it, Green Mountain?
Somebody with no imagination named that one.
I don't know. I was on it, not looking down on it.
He sent Diane to get a map of just the town. Gary and I sat there looking at each other until she returned, the only sound his foot tapping under the table. When she got back, Gary handed me a pen and asked me to draw the route I'd driven. I tried to rough it out the best I could.
Can you take us to it?
There's no way I'm going back up there. I still had the keys to the van gripped in my hand, and now I shoved them across the table to Gary. The van's parked across the street. He sent Diane out with the keys. She must have given them to someone outside because she was back in about 2 seconds. Something tickled at the back of my mind. If I was only about 4 hours away, Mom could have left right away and still been in Port Northfield that night. Why is it taking my mom so long to get here?
Your stepfather is working tonight and they can't leave until the morning.
Gary stated it like a fact, so I took it like a fact. But I wondered why she didn't drive up by herself. Not to mention, since when did Wayne work at night? It was rare enough he even had a job. I figured Gary told them not to come until the next day so he could question me without them there. Gary excused himself and left me alone in the room with Diane for a few minutes. I stared at the wall above her head.
Your mother will be here soon. She was so happy to hear you've been found. She's missed you a lot.
I hadn't been found. I'd found them. When Gary returned, he said he'd sent some people to look for the cabin. One of the cops used to hunt in that area and thought he might know where it was. I still hadn't told them I killed the freak or said anything about my baby. And at the thought of all the questions they might ask, my head hurt. I needed to be by myself. I needed to be away from these people. I don't want to answer any more questions. Gary looked like he wanted to press on, but Diane said, "How about everyone gets a good night's sleep, and then we can pick up in the morning? That okay with you, Annie?"
"Sure, whatever."
They booked a room in a motel for me and took the rooms on either side. Diane asked if I wanted her to stay with me, but I shut that one down fast. There wasn't going to be any late-night girl bonding here. She also asked what I'd like to eat, but my stomach was in knots, and I managed to decline politely. I didn't feel like turning the TV on, and there wasn't a phone in the room, so I lay on the bed staring at the ceiling until it got dark and I turned off the light. When I was just about asleep, I felt the weight of the darkness pressing down on me. Then I heard something. A door creak. A window opening. I leapt out of bed, but when I threw the lights on, there was nothing. I grabbed a flat pillow, a blanket, and the pack sack, and crawled into the closet, where I slept fitfully until I heard the maid roll her cart down the hallway in the morning. A few minutes later, Diane came knocking on my door, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, bearing coffee and a muffin. She sat on the edge of the bed, talking too loud and giving me a headache while I picked at the muffin. I didn't want to have a shower with her there, so I just splashed some water on my face and ran a brush through my hair for maybe 2 seconds. She drove me back to the little concrete room at the cop shop, where Gary was already seated with a tray of coffees and styrofoam cups. As Diane and I settled in, a young, pretty cop brought in a couple of pads of paper, blushing and sneaking peeks at Gary when she handed them over. He glanced at her as he thanked her, then focused his gaze on me. Disappointment radiated off her as she walked out. He was wearing another nice suit, dark blue with silver pinstripes, and a blue-gray shirt that set off his silver-streaked hair. I wondered if that was why he'd picked it. Seeing me glare at the mirror, Gary said,
"No one's in there, and we'll only turn the camera back on if you tell us it's okay."
Wishing I could see through it, I stared hard at the mirror and hugged the pack sack to my chest.
"Would you feel more comfortable if you had a look for yourself?"
I was surprised by the offer. I looked at his face, decided he meant it, so there was no point in checking, and shook my head. He started by asking me to describe in as much detail as possible exactly how the freak had abducted me. Whenever he asked a question, he leaned back in his chair with both hands splayed on the table in front of him, and when it was my turn to answer, he leaned toward me with both arms flat on the table and his head cocked to the side. I tried to find a pattern to his questions, but I just couldn't predict where he'd go next. Didn't even understand the relevance of some. The hair on the back of my neck was damp with sweat. Retelling that day and describing the freak made my mouth dry and my heart lurch around in my chest. But I kept it together until Gary told me the cops who'd investigated the crime scene had found the freak's body.
"He appears to have been hit with something in the head.
Is that how he died, Annie?" I looked back and forth between them, wishing I could read their minds. Gary didn't sound accusing, but I could feel the tension in the room. I hadn't even thought about what some of my choices or actions might look like to someone who hadn't been there. The room seemed hot, Diane's perfume overwhelming in the small space. I wondered how Gary would feel if I puked all over his nice suit. I raised my eyes to his. I killed him. Gary said,
I have to caution you at this time that you need not say anything further, and that anything you do say may be used as evidence against you in a court of law. You have a right to consult an attorney and to have one present during our questioning. If you can't afford one, we can provide some phone numbers for legal aid, do you understand?
The words sounded routine, and I didn't think I was going to be in trouble, but I considered asking for a lawyer. The idea of delaying this process to talk to another suit made my head hurt.
I get it.
You don't want a lawyer?
He said it casually, but I knew he didn't want me to ask for one.
No.
Gary made a note.
How did you do it?
I hit him in the back of the head with an axe. I swear my voice echoed, and even though it was hot as hell, my skin broke out in goosebumps. Gary's eyes burrowed into me like he was trying to read my thoughts, and I busied myself with ripping my styrofoam cup into little pieces.
Was he attacking you at the time?
No.
Why did you kill him, Annie?
I looked up and met his eyes.
What a stupid fucking question.
Maybe because he abducted me, beat me, raped me pretty much every night and... I stopped myself before I said anything about the baby.
Would you feel more comfortable talking with just Constable Bouchard about this?
Gary's face was grave as he waited for me to answer. Staring back at them, I wanted to smear Diane's sympathetic expression across her face. I knew I'd rather deal with Gary's tough, no-muss-no-fuss approach than get one more understanding look from her. I shook my head and Gary made another note. Then he leaned in so close across the table, I smelled cinnamon on his breath.
When did you kill him?
His voice was quiet, but it wasn't soft. A couple of days ago.
Why didn't you leave right away?
I couldn't.
Why not? Were you restrained?
Gary's fingers tapped on the table and his head was cocked. That's not what I meant. I wanted to get up and walk out the door, but the firmness in his voice had me nailed to my chair.
So why couldn't you leave?
I was looking for something. Bile rose in my throat.
What?
My body grew even colder, and Gary's edges blurred in front of my eyes.
We found a basket,
he said,
and some baby clothes.
The stupid rickety ceiling fan creaked as it went around and around, and I wondered for a minute whether it would crash down on my head. There were no windows, and I couldn't get a deep breath of air.
Is there a baby, Annie?
My head pounded. I would not cry.
Is there a baby, Annie?
Gary wouldn't shut the fuck up. No.
Was there a baby, Annie?
His voice was gentle. Yes.
Where's the baby now?
She, my baby, died.
I'm very sorry to hear that, Annie.
His voice was still gentle, soft and low. Sounded like he meant it.
That's a terrible thing. How did your baby die?
He was the first person to express condolences. The first person to say it mattered that she'd died. I looked at all the little ripped up pieces of styrofoam on the table. Someone answered him, but I didn't feel like it was me. He just... I don't know. I clung to the calm in Gary's voice as he said very gently,
Where's her body, Annie?
The strange voice answered again. When I woke up, he had her. She was dead. I don't know where he took her, he wouldn't tell me. I looked everywhere.
Everywhere.
You guys have to look, okay? Please, can you find her? Can you? My voice broke and I shut up. Gary's shoulders stiffened. His face flushed under his tan as his jaw tightened and his hands balled into fists on the table like he wanted to punch someone. At first, I thought he was mad at me.
but then I realized he was furious at the freak. Diane's eyes were shiny in the fluorescent light. All the walls closed in. My body was drenched in sweat, and sobs tried to come out of my throat, but I couldn't breathe, and they piled up, strangling me. When I tried to stand, the room tilted, so I dropped the pack sack and gripped the back of the chair, but it started to slide. My ears rang. Diane rushed to my side and lowered me slowly until I was lying on the floor, halfway across her, with my head on her chest and her arms encircling me. The harder I tried to suck some air into my lungs, the more my throat closed up. I was going to die there on that cold floor. Crying and gagging at the same time, I pushed Diane's hands off me and tried to pull away from her, but the harder I struggled, the harder she hung on. I heard screaming, realized it was me. I was powerless to stop the screams, which bounced off the walls and echoed in my head. Up came the coffee and muffin, all over myself and Diane. She still wouldn't let me go. My head rested on her huge boobs, which smelled like warm vanilla cookies. Gary crouched in front of us, saying something I couldn't hear. As Diane rocked me back and forth in her arms, I wanted to struggle and take back control, but my mind and body wouldn't cooperate. I lay there, sobbing and screaming. The screaming finally stopped, but I felt so cold and everyone's voices seemed to be coming from far away. Diane whispered, "Everything's going to be okay, Annie. You're safe now." What a crock. I wanted to tell her I was never going to be okay or safe, but when I tried to form the words, my lips froze. Then there was a new set of feet in front of me next to Gary's crouched figure. A voice said, "She's hyperventilating. Annie, my name is Dr. Berger. Try to take some deep breaths." But I couldn't, and I don't remember anything after that.